Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Urologist Speaks with BME Urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and my co-host, as always, Dr. Wesley Francis, is a well-known surgical oncologist and general surgeon. Momentarily, we have our guest of honor, who is also well-known, well-respected throughout the community and in the medical community as well, and that is Dr. Christine Parker-Curling, who is an internist and endocrinologist. So we have a very interesting show today. We're going to try to get as much information out of our resident endocrinologist, Dr. Parker-Curling, as we can. We're going to talk about cancer as well with our cancer specialist, not only for the Bahamas, but for the region, in the form of Dr. Wesley Francis. But what we're going to talk about today is, why are we always feeling tired? Why are we as a nation chronically fatigued? And it's not just our nation, but the world as a whole. This generation is more fatigued than the generation before, and that generation is more fatigued than the one before that. Is it related to technology? Is it related to our hectic life? Is it because of the population? It's more competitive. There are many reasons for it, but we're going to talk about the physiological aspects of it, the emotional, the psychological issues that can lead to fatigue. So many of us feel that feeling tired is basically normal. A normal part of our life. The abnormal has become a normal. So we push through it with caffeine, with sugar to get through, with alcohol to manage our symptoms and our stress, or to even try to fall asleep, which is a dangerous combination. So we need to understand fatigue. We understand our body. So we are very well versed. We can be rat subjects from our previous life in terms of residency training.
We still there sometimes.
Yeah, well, it is, but it waxes and wanes.
Not,
it waxes and
bad,
wanes. It's not constant. So
right,
residency right. For surgery, they say to make diamonds, you have to crush with overwhelming pressure. So that's exactly what you do. Got to do in surgical residency, which is usually 5 years and usually 2 years for fellowship. So
it's a little more gentler now, though, because we have a different set of people, right?
It is. I think they have more rules that are
right,
more stringent.
Right.
If you're on call, you got to be out of the hospital by 11 a.m. It wasn't so fortunate for us.
In our days, there was no law against how long you had to be or you could be in the hospital. I think when I was finishing, we had to bring in the 80-hour work week rule. You know, people work 40 hours a week, but they had to put a law to limit us to 80 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember that? I don't know if you remember that.
But. Yeah, it the law was coming in, but it was never pertained to my urology
Well, that's
specialty.
More the U.S. I mean,
yes.
I was U.S. trained, and it was in my final year, and I was administrative chief resident and had to be actually administering this new rule. And I was the biggest offender because, I mean, it was culture for us to just be around, to be doing work, staying up, taking care of patients on a daily basis. And, you know, we believe that that's how we learned. You learn by doing. And so...
Well, the only reprieve I really had is before I, I got into urology, I had to do general surgery, and I had to rotate through trauma. And in trauma, you had to physically leave by 11 o'clock, and you had to sign out, you had to hand over your patients. You were not allowed to be in the hospital, on the premises, beyond 11 a.m. post-call. And that just makes sense.
Back in Detroit in my day, we never signed out. I mean, we were supposed to, but we didn't. But we are here going to talk today about really the endocrine system. And, you know, so we have this esteemed endocrinologist here.
Author. World-renowned author.
World-renowned.
Podcaster as well.
She's a bestseller.
Bestseller, yes.
I mean, we need to
and
go
the
on
better
her
half,
podcast.
The better half of our sometime co-host and our friend, Devon Curley.
Devon Curley. Certainly the better half, right?
So we're talking about a lot that would pertain to your specialty, Dr. Perkut Curling, and that's just the chronic fatigue that we are undergoing as a society. Why are we always tired? So many of the reasons medically, physiologically are related to your specialty.
Yeah, but one of the things I think she could enlighten us and our audience is really the effect of the endocrine system on all of what we do. I mean, just living. You know, I always think the endocrine system, these small organs, but they have such a great effect on the entire body's physiology. And this subspecialty has become so important because of that. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Particularly in this country where we're overwhelmed with obesity. We're overwhelmed with...
And that's an endocrine problem, right?
Hypothyroidism.
Yeah. That's an endocrine problem.
Hypothyroidism. We have issues with low testosterone that's related to obstructive sleep.
Could be an endocrine problem.
Yeah, so there... And obviously, the big D, diabetes.
That's a huge endocrine problem.
That is a huge endocrine, and that affects all of us. Everybody knows someone who has diabetes, who has been negatively impacted by diabetes, and we want to prevent persons from losing their toe. And then losing their forefoot, and then losing their below-the-knee amputation, above-the-knee amputation with an infected diabetic foot. So we're trying to be proactive, as we always say. The cornerstone of this show is preventative medicine. Let's not just react. Let's prevent thousands of Bahamians or even the next generation from going down the road to being diabetic or pre-diabetic. I think the last numbers were that at least 1 in 7 adults, male and female, are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. That is overwhelming. Speak to us a little bit, Dr. Parker Culling, about why is diabetes such a issue in this country? Is it related to genetics, racial heritage? Is it related to sedentary lifestyle? Is it related to our processed food and our poor dietary choices?
Oh, thank you. Well, I think you did a pretty excellent summary just now about why we have such a high incidence and prevalence of diabetes and other metabolic disorders in our population. Now affecting individuals at younger or earlier ages than we would have seen previously. When I discuss things like diabetes, we want to classify the risk factors, the things that increase your risk of developing such conditions into what we call modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. So the things that you can modify are things that are within your power to change. And then the things that you can't really modify are things that you're born with. And those would be things like your family history, your genetic predisposition. So there's definitely going to be some degree of not necessarily a direct inheritance, but some type of genetic predisposition to developing such conditions. But this is going to be exacerbated, or the manifestation of your risk, the actual development of diabetes and prediabetes is going to be brought forward by things that decrease the efficiency of the insulin that you are producing. So outside of somebody with type 1 diabetes who is not producing insulin, which is, you know, an autoimmune type of destruction of the pancreas, also with a strong genetic component, what's happening to us is we exist in an environment where there is an abundance of calories. So if we think back to the environment that we might have been in many, many, many decades ago, in order to acquire 500 calories, you might have had to burn 700 of those calories just to go get the food.
Kill and eat.
Right, you had to kill and eat. And also the quality of the calories that you're getting would have been different. So now we can acquire literally a day and a half worth of calories in one meal, and we can drive up to a window and obtain it. And further, the types of calories or the types of foods that we are eating are so filled with calories, but with so few nutritive value and so little things like fiber that we don't really feel full or satisfied for a long time after eating or consuming such a meal. So you might go to your neighborhood coffee shop and you might get a muffin with a whatever pacino with some, you know, whipped cream on top, and you feel great for like half an hour.
Right, right.
Before lunch, you were hungry again because you had a very high calorie, nutrient poor meal. And so then you go get a large sized sugar sweetened beverage with a sandwich and some fries, and you feel full for an hour. So you've eaten about, I don't know, depending on what you got, 2 days worth of calories, but you're not burning that. So when we don't burn the calories that we consume, when we don't burn the energy, we store it as fat. And this is another endocrine organ, really, that kind of produces insulin resistance and increases your risk of developing diabetes. So I think we have the perfect storm.
So you mentioned type 1 diabetes, and some of our listeners may not know the difference between type 1 and type 2 as and it relates to the endocrine organ.
They talk about diabetes type 1.5.
Right.
Well, right. So educate us a little bit about that, and a little bit about the pancreas as an endocrine organ, right? People think of a pancreas in different ways,
but that's true.
The endocrine aspect of the pancreas. Tell us about
this.
This
is true. So the major, for the purposes of this discussion, the major endocrine function of the pancreas is to produce the hormone called insulin. And generally, when we eat, chew, swallow, digest, absorb our foods, one of the nutrients that we absorb, which is natural, which is appropriate, is sugar. So when sugar is absorbed into the circulation from your meal, your body produces a hormone called insulin from the pancreas, which travels to the bloodstream, and it essentially escorts the sugars from your circulation into the muscles where you use it for energy. So somebody with type 1 diabetes is someone whose pancreas has lost its ability to produce insulin over time. So those patients are not making insulin at all or not making enough insulin to normalize their blood sugar. So the treatment for them is to take insulin. In another population, what tends to happen is, you know, if we want to talk about it in a relatable way, when we consume a lot of sugar, which is obvious sugars in sweet things, in, you know, pastries and in desserts, we also have the hidden sugars that are in things like rice, potato, bread, pasta, corn that are converted to sugar as soon as you digest them. So when you produce large amounts of sugar, your body produces large amounts of insulin. And this is all in an effort to get that sugar out of your circulation, move it into the muscles, etc., where you use it for energy. Over time, we talked about the fact that when you're not burning your calories, you're storing them as fat. And the fat in the body actually decreases the efficiency of your insulin, right? So your body overcomes that by making more insulin. So I like to explain to my patients that when you are pre-diabetic or you're diabetic, it's almost like you are a little bit deaf to the insulin. And so your body overcomes this by making more insulin. Mm-hmm. It's a double-edged sword because while the insulin helps to lower the blood sugar, the insulin predisposes to weight gain. But then weight gain predisposes to your insulin working less effectively. So then when you gain weight, your insulin is working less effectively. So then when you eat these carbohydrate-rich foods, you make more insulin because your insulin is inefficient. So it is a disorder that perpetuates itself. So when your body is unable to lower the blood sugar effectively, that's when you see, when you check your blood sugar levels, they are now above normal levels. So your body could compensate for excess amounts of sugar until your pancreas is essentially making the greatest amount of insulin that it could possibly make. And then when you start to give yourself more sugar, the pancreas says, I am producing 100% of the insulin that I am capable of producing at this point in time. Right. So I'm just not going to get rid of any of the sugar that you're eating right now. And that's when the blood sugar becomes high, the patient becomes thirsty, the lens becomes, you know, a little bit contracted and dehydrated because now the body's trying to find sources of water. So patients will have the blurred vision. The kidneys' ability to concentrate the urine is changing now, and they're having excessive urination. They're dehydrated. And then what happens, you can even have weight loss if you're no longer too able to absorb the calories. So, you know, patients present with lots of things that manifest as type 2 diabetes. So the type 1 diabetic person is not making insulin. The type 2 diabetic is usually making a lot of insulin, but their body's being challenged with so much sugar that they cannot make enough insulin to lower the blood sugar to a normal level. And that's why, I suppose, we call it sugar. So right. Now you have sugar because you're walking around with the sugar in your circulation because you just don't have the capacity to get rid of it.
And diabetes in itself is a serious plague on our society on so many levels. It can be deadly. It's significant morbidity, significant mortality. We can talk about all the negative consequences of uncontrolled diabetes or poorly controlled or undiagnosed diabetes.
Yeah.
So we can talk even from surgical perspective. We talk about amputations. We can talk about renal failure. We can talk about issues related to your eye, losing your eyesight. But we also need to talk about malignancy. We have a country that has a high incidence of malignancy. We talk about insulin resistance and obesity and the inflammatory response related to that, and the increased risk of numerous cancers because of that as well. So if we can avoid obesity, we can avoid diabetes, we can in fact improve the quality of life and reduce our risk of having numerous cancers.
So what's fascinating about this also, I mean, you mentioned about how the sugars really are metabolized, insulin help metabolize in the muscle. How does exercise influence this whole cycle?
That's a great question. It's an excellent question. And I will answer a different question first.
Okay.
Well, I'll answer the question because Dr. Pinto said something about, you know, you have all this high sugar and then we have these increased risk of cardiovascular disease, amputations, loss of vision, loss of kidney function. And the question that might come up is, well, why? What is the link? So what? My sugar is high. Why is this accounting for these complications, as we call them?
Well, let me also say, my perspective as a urologist, the number one plague in our society that diabetes has is erectile dysfunction.
Yeah, all the fellas listening now,
thank
right?
you. I forgot the most important organ.
We are on the urology speak, right?
We are on the urologist speak. The urologist speaks.
Definitely.
Okay.
Fellas so perked up just now.
We have time. What did they?
Yeah, we got plenty of time.
Okay. So what's happening in a very simple nutshell is where, you know, the blood vessels are little pipes. Little hoses, a pipe that is designed to carry blood from one part of the body to another. And I like to tell my patients that, you know, these pipes, just as a steel pipe is not necessarily designed to carry a fluid that's rich in salt. So if you're pumping salty water through these pipes, you can cause erosion, you can cause damage to the walls of those pipes. So in a likewise manner, these blood vessels, when they are exposed to high concentrations of sugar, you can cause damage to the blood vessel walls.
Yes.
When you add cholesterol to that mixture, it's almost like, you know, pasting butter to the walls of the blood vessels, and it produces clogging and decreased ability to carry this fluid around. So when the blood vessel walls of the heart and the brain and the kidneys and the blood vessels in the eyes and the blood vessels that surround the nerves to the feet become damaged, they're no longer able to provide blood, which carries nutrients to these organs. And once these organs are starved of blood and proper nutrition, this is when you develop the complications in those organs. So what does exercise do? What role does exercise have to play? Well, in the management of diabetes, there's multiple things we want to do. The first thing we want to do is decrease the amount of sugar that we're exposing our body to. So if you're listening, if you're out there in radio land, the first thing that you can empower yourself to do is decrease the carbohydrates, the sugars that you're consuming. The obvious ones and the rice, potato, bread, pasta, corn that makes up maybe 70% of our plate when we eat.
Can I make one comment while you're on this point? I'm going to be the typical Bahamian patient who I see every single day, several times a day. Okay, doc, yeah, I have sugar. I need insulin now and then, but you know what? I cut out the potato salad. I cut out the macaroni and cheese. I walk twice a week, so I don't need to take any insulin. I don't need to check my sugar at all. I don't need to take my high blood pressure medication because I feel fine, and I cut out all the salt. So, no, I don't claim it. I don't have diabetes. I don't have hypertension. That machine is wrong. Those blood results are wrong. I feel completely fine. Then all of a sudden, you get a blood test a few years later because they come in with malaise and nausea and vomiting, and you see they're in renal dysfunction. They have issues if they're a male with erectile dysfunction. They have issues related to the heart, et cetera, et cetera. How do we catch these people early before they're suffering? Because a lot of them are only going to act once they're suffering. Let's be preventative and prevent them from going down that road to be having stage 3 renal failure or never being able to rise again unless we have to go to the fourth stage of treatment for erectile dysfunction.
That's replacement.
Well, be even before
what
that.
What is that?
Injectables. Injectables.
Okay.
Injectables.
Ain't nobody want to do injectables. Yes. But anyway.
Boy, I don't know. Depends. So we get rid of we minimize the sugars we introduce into the body. We burn them. We burn the sugars that we do introduce, and that's where exercise comes in.
Exactly.
So you want to burn the sugars that you are introducing to your body with exercise. And then the third thing we do is introduce medications if we have to, if lifestyle alone isn't there. You ask a very interesting question, and this is a question we struggle with daily. And the reason we struggle, well, the question, I'll reference it again, was how do we get people not to get to the point where they are experiencing complications? This is hard because the problem with diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol is that when most of the damage is occurring, the patient is typically experiencing no symptoms.
Silent killers.
Silent. It's so while they are, you know, producing absolute destruction to the integrity of your blood vessels, you will feel, in general, nothing. And so it's difficult to sell to a patient that something is going on when they feel perfectly fine. And so I suppose educational programming, like what you're doing now, and somehow trying to convince a patient or explain to the population that even though you feel fine, the way you feel is not a good enough indicator of how you are doing and what your health status is. And so that's why we have to encourage the primary prevention, the screening.
Well, I'll
check,
say
check,
it again.
Check.
I'll hammer home what I was speaking about before. The most important organ for half our population is being able to rise.
And hammer.
And hammer to be the best carpenter there is. But that has actually saved hundreds of men's lives.
True.
By coming in, because of erectile dysfunction, we can figure out, all right, you already have end stage, or before you get to end stage renal failure, or you have some diabetes, or hypertension, or you're hypercholesterolemia, or you have early coronary artery disease. That can prevent you from going down that road. And that entryway for a man to go and see a physician is usually because the erections are not working. And unfortunately, they'll probably wait years before they muster enough coverage to come and see someone. But eventually they do. And if they realize that if they listen to what the physician is telling them and they change their lifestyle, they lose the weight, they take the medication, they follow up biannually, and they see that their erections have improved, they'll remember in their mind what they felt like when they felt that their life was over, when they had no erections. They're never going to want to go back to that. So that could be the motivation. So I use that to motivate most of the men I see daily. And that's, you know what? Let's get your erections all the way into your 80s and 90s. Let's get you to your 80s and 90s.
Yeah, that first.
And what you do now, even in your teenage years, mm-hmm. your 20s, your 30s, that's what's going to dictate what they'll say your final decade on this earth is. For most people, they don't know what it is, although some people may have an idea when they feel that things are going down, or even we're not even talking about chronological age. But you want to live that best possible decade of your life. And for most men, they're in their retirement age. They want their erections working.
Agreed. But here you can now see, because we're talking about diabetes, the effects of it on what we call target organs or end organs, right? losing the eyesight, and we see the amount of people who have eye disease and the burden that is on our health system. We see the amount of people that have cardiovascular disease, the burden that is on our health system, kidney disease, all of the people who are now on dialysis, and that's related to all of that. So you see how longitudinally, you know, and what we see now, the diabetic feet.
Yeah, a diabetic foot can have somebody in the hospital six weeks.
Right, and so that's a bet that's held up. And I always say that, you know, diabetic foot is a primary care issue. It's a primary care problem. We just happen to be at the end of this road, picking this up, trying to take care of the foot itself, when really, if you took care of the endocrine aspect of it from before, or the lifestyle aspect and the choices from before, we would never have to be here. And so when you couple all of that together and you look at the burden now on our health system, no matter how much money you pump into that, you know, it's not going to work and be as efficient, and you're not going to get the outcomes that you're actually looking for. All right. So these are the things that the realities
and
of our system.
Too many of our fellow Bahamians and residents are hard-headed. I've seen it from intern years to senior house officer and even being a consultant. How many diabetics come in because of diabetic ketoacidosis or even in diabetic coma? And they don't learn their lesson three, 4 months later, they're back again. Mm-hmm. And then they're back again. And you may see them six times in a year, spending a third of that year in a hospital bed, fighting for their life.
The problem here, as she states, is this latency period when you don't feel anything. It's that asymptomatic period when basically, you know, because there's so much redundancies in what God made our body and our physiology such that you have all kind of redundancies and systems that feedback and keep things as normal as possible until everything fall off. And it's that period. It is that period when really intervention should happen, but you feel fine and you don't go anywhere, right? You don't see your doctor, and that's when we really need to act. How do we reach out to people with that? I mean, the messaging is there. I mean, you know, there's a lot of messaging out there. There's NHI, right?
Mm-hmm. Accessible.
So, I mean, we always beat up on the government and all that, but it's still there. The access is there. Mm-hmm. Are we utilizing what we have available for prevention? And that's the big problem.
People, a lot of Bahamians, unfortunately, for them, ignorance is bliss. They just don't want to know. They don't want to deal with it. They'll kick the can down the road, and they just don't want to deal with it. A lot of it is maybe even childhood trauma. They saw what their grandmother or their grandfather went through with this disease process or that disease process, in and out of hospital.
Yeah, but we're in the information age now. You know what I mean? Like, everything is... Listen, everybody has a cell phone. Everybody knows. Well, hopefully people can read. And even if they can't read, they can listen, right? They can hear things and try to understand. We're in this information age. Those are not excuses anymore.
Well, you also have to say, you don't want Google to be your doctor. And if you're going to look at anything, it has to be from a reputable source. I've seen even during COVID.
Agreed.
Even we have colleagues
of ours. Well,
everybody
became an expert during COVID, right? Which, again, that's another show.
So definitely.
Right? but the problem is we have enough information out there for people to then, you know, I always give the analogy with your cars, right? You don't wait for your car to break down, right? You have preventive maintenance. Mm-hmm. You go every 3 months or 6 months or whatever to get the oil change or whatever so that you can maintain that car. Think about it. If you only had one car that you could, you can't exchange it, you can't buy another one, only one, what would you do to maintain that car? That car is your body. Only one you get.
But we have to talk about the culture. We have to talk about the uphill battle we're fighting, because I've seen it. I know you've seen it. And all of our colleagues have seen it. We've seen patients who've had stroke, who are hemiplegic. They're coming into the office. They're taking 10 minutes because they're dragging their foot or their leg, and they have slurred speech, and they're depressed and miserable. And then we check their blood pressure. It's 260 over 130. Do you take your medication? Nah, I don't bother. I already had a stroke. It can't get any worse. That's their mentality.
And
if somebody went through being diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer, then you know what? We'll do what we can to give you as many good years of quality life on this earth. But you know what? Speak to your nephews. Speak to your sons. Speak to the men in your church. Use what you went through as an example so others that you care about, and you should care about everyone, do not go through what you went through.
Okay. So we spoke about diabetes. We spoke about the pancreas as an organ, really, that leads to type 1, type 2 diabetes. And we have this fantastic endocrinologist here. Let's go back to this endocrine system. Let's talk about this thyroid now, because that's another endocrine organ. And, you know, the effects of thyroid on almost every aspect of life.
I mean, let's talk about, first of all, what are some of the symptoms of hypothyroidism and some of the symptoms of hyperthyroidism, because it's very common. And is it more prevalent in males or females? What is the most common age for someone to be diagnosed with a thyroid disorder?
Okay, so
and then we also need to talk about the malignant. That's so where you will come in.
Let's talk about the thyroid. What is it used for? And then the hypo and the hyper.
Right. So, okay. Right. So we can discuss the thyroid gland, which is a, you know, butterfly or bow tie shaped organ that is in the front part of your neck. It produces hormones called thyroid hormones. And the thyroid hormones have an effect on every organ system in the body, pretty much. Every organ system in the body is what we would call regulated in some way by the thyroid hormone. And so when we think about the function of the thyroid hormone, I tend to tell patients that too much thyroid hormone speeds things up too much, and too little thyroid hormone slows things down too much. So the thyroid hormone is like a regulator of the pace of function of the organs that are affected by the thyroid hormone. So if we go like in a head-to-toe manner, you can say, well, if I have an excess amount of thyroid hormone, maybe my mind's racing, I can't sleep, I could be a little bit aggressive, and the cardiovascular system, my heart could be racing, and the nervous system, I could be a little shaky.
But the problem is a lot of persons, they don't go for their annual physicals.
Well, that too.
They'll say that this is menopause.
Yes.
They'll say that, you know what, I'm putting on the weight because I just don't have time to exercise, I'm eating poorly. So they always chalk it up to something else. And if they were to get screening, they can have all their problems solved by determining what the root cause is. And it's part of the annual physicals. We're checking your thyroid function.
Yeah. And many times you'll have no symptoms. Or to Dr. Pinto's point, many of the symptoms of excess or too little thyroid hormone, we call them, maybe we say that they are symptoms that could be present in other conditions. Yeah. We call them non-specific symptoms.
Non-specific, yes.
So a non-specific symptom means it does not make it obvious to you what's wrong, but you might know something is wrong. And it's not that unusual for a menopausal woman to come into the office with fatigue, heat intolerance, you know, maybe some elevated heart rate, some irritability, all of these things, and say, I think this might
be
menopause.
Lots of irritability.
Yeah. And so the appropriate evaluation should include your thyroid function, because not that infrequently we'll find that patient was actually hyperthyroid and that perhaps hormone replacement therapy was not the way to go. So in summary about the function of the thyroid, regulatory, and too much speeds things up and too little thyroid hormone slows things down. And that would be the mechanism of the symptoms that someone might come with. So you're tired, you're fatigued, you're having some weight gain, you could be hypothyroid. But I'll stick a pin here in my own point. And to Dr. Pindle's point, and I think this is related to our lifestyle. Many times patients have difficulty losing weight. And if you have a history of thyroid problems, many times they pin the difficulty with weight loss on the hypothyroidism.
Right.
But oftentimes the degree of hypothyroidism is not enough to explain the difficulty with weight gain. And in many scenarios, it comes right back down to the lifestyle.
Yeah, but we have overwhelming problem, and I was talking about that at the onset of the show, with fatigue, acute fatigue, chronic fatigue, obesity. There's so many reasons for it. We need to determine why. I mean, we can talk some of the common ones. Hypothyroidism is one. Mm-hmm. We talk about adrenal insufficiency, the importance of cortisol. Maybe you can speak a little bit about...
We can go to the adrenal next.
Yes, we'll go to the adrenal next.
Right. But there's we're going to touch all the endocrine today.
I mean, we talk about anemia. There are so many persons in this country who have anemia, and they try to treat it and try to determine what the cause is. It might be colon cancer.
Right.
So all they're going to do is take their iron tablets,
and
which causes the constipation to even be worse. And then when they get the black stool, which is actually digested blood, Melina stools, they'll say it's the iron tablets. Yeah. And that has led to deadly consequences where a person had early signs of colon cancer and they led to it being stage four. Mm-hmm. We'll talk more with our wonderful guest, Dr. Christine Parker Curling, on the other end of the break.
Ready to kick off the new school year with a bang. It's the Guardian Media Group and Rotary Club of South Ocean's Back to School Jamboree. Friday, August 29th in the parking lot of the Nassau Guardian in Oaksville, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Join us for a day of fun, games, and back to school excitement. We've got something for everyone, from bouncing castles and face painting to health screenings, hair grooming, and giveaways. Meet some of your favorite local businesses and get ready for the new school year with all the essentials. We'll have school supply vendors and local eateries with delicious treats. Don't miss out on the fun. The Guardian Media Group and Rotary Club of South Ocean's Back to School Jamboree. Friday, August 29th at the Nassau Guardians parking lot, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's the perfect way to celebrate the end of summer and get excited for a great school year. See you here.
Brought to you by The Walking Clinic, Boss, Alive, FML, Asa H. Pritchett, Nassau Agencies, Original Parties, Caribbean Bottling Limited, Purity, Ari the Artist, Little Caesars, Marco's, Wendy's.
Girl, Junior just showed me Bulla Boy in his phone.
What you mean? He take picture of that good for nothing boy?
Shh, you don't want Bulla hair, you say that. You know she always say that's my good child.
So what he doing in Junior phone?
Oh, he there because the police looking for him. He on that wanted list.
Wanted persons in your phone now?
Yes, child. And when police want find anybody quick, after something happened, they can send picture direct to your phone. Go to Google Play or App Store and search for Crack Crime Bahamas, then pick install and it'll go straight to your phone.
There is also a section on missing persons.
Yes, girl. Everybody needs to get this app so police can tell us right away when these people go missing. Just like an alert system.
Yes, it has numbers for Crime Stoppers Bahamas so you can call and nobody knows you. Call directly to Miami and give the information without giving your name or anything about you. I tried it the other day, and when I hear Junior and his boys talking about where they hide those guns, I walk quick round the corner and call that number.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Urologist Speaks with the Amy Urologist, Dr. Gregory Pinto. We have my co-host, Dr. Wesley Francis, who I've actually never saw on the radio, although he's my contemporary. He's actually, I see him as a mentor as well. So, thank you for being you, Dr. Wesley Francis.
Absolutely. It's always good to be here with my good pal, my brother.
And we have, as you say, we're so honored. We're almost intimidated.
Yes.
Because of your high level of intelligence. I wasn't intimidated like this when your husband was on last week.
No.
I felt more relaxed. Now I'm feeling a little bit on edge. What? So I wish I'd done more reading so I can sound as intelligent as you.
She is educating us today.
So let me ask, might seem like a silly question. Half the population are female. The vast majority of women at some point are going to become pregnant. When we talk about gestational diabetes, I know about 30% of women who develop gestational diabetes are going to go on to have diabetes postprandial, post-pregnancy. Can you actually say that pregnancy in our society is actually a risk for diabetes or worsening diabetes?
That is a very fascinating question. Thank you for asking it, Dr. Pinto.
No problem.
So yes, let's talk about diabetes and pregnancy. Well, certain aspects of it. That could be a show in and of itself. So the state of pregnancy in and of itself does perhaps increase the risk of the development of diabetes or the worsening of diabetes, because in or after about the mid stages of pregnancy, the placenta produces hormones that kind of increases the insulin resistance in the mom to increase the amount of glucose available to go across the placenta to provide that sugar for the baby. So, yes. So, the state of pregnancy can increase the risk of developing diabetes in perhaps someone who is pre-diabetic, and also can predisposed to worsening diabetes, but pregnancy in and of itself, if you develop diabetes in pregnancy, which we call gestational diabetes, it increases the risk of you being diabetic later on. So even if after the pregnancy, after you've delivered, you are no longer diabetic, your blood sugars are normal, you should be tested within 3 months, 6 months, you should be tested several times that year, with the calendar year, within that 3 to 6 months post-pregnancy to see if you have developed or maintained your diabetes status. So I think there are many instances when patients say, well, I had diabetes in pregnancy, but I didn't really follow up or know that I was supposed to check to see if I remain diabetic. Another risk factor is is that if you gain significant amounts of weight in pregnancy and you are unable to lose some of that weight, that in and of itself is going to increase your insulin resistance and increase the risk of pregnancy, increase the risk of diabetes during and after the pregnancy. So is it a risk factor? It's not traditionally thought of as a risk factor, but in many ways it is.
And if you have multiple pregnancies, that puts you at greater risk.
Right.
If the time between each pregnancy is a short period, that'll put you at greater risk.
And obviously, if you're not losing weight in between, and if you have gestational diabetes with each of those pregnancies.
Talk a little bit about the importance of eating right, getting exercise when a woman is pregnant.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I would lean on my OBGYN friends to talk about the amount of weight gain that's appropriate during gestational period, during pregnancy. But basically, the heavier you are going into a pregnancy, the recommendation for the amount of weight that you should gain is actually less. So you shouldn't be gaining significant amounts of weight in pregnancy if you are in the obese category already. Minimal amount of weight loss. And so that might have to include maybe a supervised regulation of your caloric intake. So perhaps you might need to enlist the expertise of a dietitian. But it's probably things we don't think about. It's probably things that we don't talk to or think about. And you might want to modify your diet, even if you're not diabetic, to decrease your risk of developing diabetes in that pregnancy and after. So it's important.
And under the guise of your specialty, we're talking about fatigue, which is a pandemic in this society. There are too many of us who just get by with caffeine, and it just is a Band-Aid on the problem. Talk to us a little bit about the overwhelming problem of fatigue in this country. I mean, there's so many reasons for it, but just in terms of physiologically, someone comes to you and says, you know what, for the last year, I just feel run down. I have brain fog. I barely can get up in the morning. I feel like I need to take a nap every afternoon. I don't have energy to do anything. I don't enjoy anything in life. The quality of my life is suffering. What are you going to do for this person? Obviously, a thorough history is in order, but what are the main causes from your specialty in regards to what can possibly causing this chronic fatigue?
Why, thank you. So fatigue is common. And from the history and physical examination, that might direct which area I'm going to be investigating for the cause of the fatigue. So, you know, sometimes it could be hypothyroidism or even hyperthyroidism, you know, inadequate amounts of thyroid hormone, you're fatigued. It could be anemia. And so I like Dr. Pinto's point. I usually tell my patients anemia is not a diagnosis. Anemia really is a sign that something else is going on. You're either not producing appropriate amount of red blood cells or you're losing your red blood cells. So anemia in and of itself is not a diagnosis, and the underlying cause needs to be investigated. And depending on your age, your gender, and other factors, that would lead us to what we are checking for. Another thing I find quite frequently is actually vitamin D deficiency. So many patients with fatigue have vitamin D deficiency. many patients with fatigue, depending on, you know, if they tell me they wake up in the morning and they're tired, no matter how much sleep they get, like, doc, I can sleep 12 hours and then I can sleep another 12 hours. If they are getting what we call non-restorative sleep, then I definitely want to screen that person for obstructive sleep apnea. They're probably, and it's very common. And yep. The risk, one of the major risk factors for obstructive sleep apnea is excess body weight, mm-hmm. because it causes, you know, excess tissue in that nasal pharyngeal area or the oropharyngeal area where we have, you know, decreased room for the air to pass into the lungs. And so that obstruction of that airway causes decreasing oxygen concentrations when they sleep. The body wakes you up just a little bit, just enough for you to breathe. And all of this is happening below your level of consciousness. So you have multiple episodes of self-awakening to maintain your oxygen. So you never get into that nice REM. You never get those nice cycles of sleep. So you wake up and you're like, first of all, I could go back to sleep because I just don't feel like I slept. So I'm going to say that that is probably under investigated.
And that's a vicious cycle.
It's a vicious cycle.
Many times, just from the male perspective, it puts you at risk of obesity.
That's true too.
Low testosterone, because the testosterone is supposed to replenish that you use throughout the day. It happens when you have REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. So then that causes you to be, you have a lack of motivation to do anything. That includes exercising or eating right. You put on weight. That obesity also causes the obstructive sleep apnea to get worse, which causes the low testosterone to get worse because of obesity. So you never get out of this cycle. And thousands of men in this country are living like a zombie, falling asleep, driving at a stop sign, fall asleep at the drop of the hat. Professionally, they're negatively impacted. Socially, they're negatively impacted. There's an increased risk, a significant one, with obstructive sleep apnea and stroke and heart disease as well, so you can get a myocardial infarction. So there's so many things that are happening that we don't discuss enough, and it's just going underdiagnosed because the average baby doesn't even know what testosterone does. They don't know what obstructive sleep apnea does. We have a call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Pinto, and to your partner.
Good evening.
I have a quick input and then a question as it relates to what the endocrinologist is saying, right? And I want to juxtapose it with that. You know, I'm always working long hours. You know, I stand on my leg a lot. And I'm always energized, right? But I find out when my energy does up, it's really let's say if I get carried away with working and then I don't eat on time. And because you're thinking you're not using energy, but you're using energy. When you eat, you feel good. But then some days, I notice even if it's depression or even just stopping energy, if I sit in the sun, I just become, my depression goes, and I become energized. I'm just telling you that. And you said vitamin D, and so that's a natural form of vitamin D. And I had looked at the molecular pathway of the vitamin D during the COVID-19 pandemic, and I saw where, if I can remember well, about 60 or 70% of this vitamin D actually goes to the immune system. So, and I saw some other events where it goes to the kidneys, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'd just like for you to comment on that. But another thing is, my wife is, from since she had the last child, because I had a child when I was about 59 or so, right? But she hasn't been able to, she's just put on more weight. She's wearing the Norplant. And I know you know what that is. And so she doesn't eat a lot, you know. But she has this what's the problem with her getting rid of this weight? And I wanted to know, because I think I read where the visceral fat plays a key role in insulin resistance. I'll hang up and listen, because I want to learn.
Well, obviously, that question is for Dr. Parker Curley. But
yeah,
I'll even talk about seasonal depression. And that happens in a lot of temperate areas of the world, North Pole, Alaska, the Canadian Northern Territories, Iceland, where you may never see the sun for a week. I lived in Vancouver, and we called it Raincouver. It would get dark at 3 o'clock, and it would rain all the time, and you may go 2 weeks and never see the sun. So the sun is very important. Yes, vitamin D is very important, getting out the sun. That's where we're blessed as a nation, with the sun, sand, and sea. But talk a little bit in regards to visceral fat and women.
Well, I think the skin as an endocrine organ.
Yes.
And I think that's what the caller alluded to.
Yeah, I mean, so there is so much research going on in the arena of vitamin D. And in fact, when we read these articles, we find out that every day we're finding out new pathways that vitamin D has become evidently important. It has always been important, but now we're just discovering all of the things in terms of the immune response, in terms of your fatigue. And so the exact molecular pathways, obviously, I won't be able to comment on just on the fly like that. But suffice it to say, after attending so many endocrine conferences, it's now something that I more often than not check. And I have a very low threshold for screening for vitamin D deficiency. And even the optimal amount of vitamin D, you know, there are studies ongoing about the risk of falls associated with low and extremely high vitamin D as we age. And so we wouldn't necessarily know the neural mechanism that causes that. So a lot of the times we also see correlations. So it has caused me maybe to decrease the goal vitamin D level that I now aim for. Because, of course, with many things, we think more is better. If my vitamin D is low, then I need my vitamin D to be high. Right. Right. So, you know, the sweet spot seems to be somewhere in maybe the 40 range because, you know, the normal vitamin D would be between 30 and 100. So we think, well, let me get to 90. You know, patients would come in and be like, doc, push my vitamin D up. And now new evidence is showing, well, you might not want to have that high of vitamin D because of increased risk of complications. And then vitamin D can cause hypercalcemia.
Yes.
So when you're supplementing your vitamin D, you have to be careful because vitamin D toxicity does exist. I like the introduction of the mental health into this conversation because you had said earlier, and then the caller mentioned, when you think of fatigue and you think of lack of interest in things you usually do, and you think of decreased pleasure and enjoyment in our society, you know, less so now than before because of social media campaigns, because of depression and anxiety and mental health disorders being displayed so widely in on the big screen. And, you know, because of how common it is to see celebrities having therapists or therapists being displayed as normal things, it is important to recognize that physical symptoms can be a manifestation of mental health concerns. So when we talk about fatigue, I think it's important to talk about your mental health and
I thoroughly agree. Mm-hmm. And depression can cause obesity. Being obese can cause depression. And that's what a lot of women in this society are going through. They can't lose that 40 pounds. Have a certain level of constant depression because of it. And low self-esteem.
That's
and
it affects them. That's precisely where it is.
Socially, it affects how they interact with in other persons and everything else. Talk about magnesium as well. Magnesium is very important as well. In terms of, even from for urologists, magnesium is a natural inhibitor of stone formation. I'll talk about my personal experience as a urologist. The overdosing and toxicity of vitamin D. Vitamin D, because they take it to the extreme. A lot of persons will Google, and they don't understand the units involved.
Right.
And they're taking 20 times what they should be taking. And because of the metabolism.
And which one they take,
and
too.
With interaction with calcium. Right. And vitamin D, they often make kidney stones. So that's the first question I have. Are you taking calcium supplementation?
Right.
Are you taking vitamin D calcium, vitamin D supplementation? And what dose? And we calculate that. And there are so many persons who have kidney stones because they're a vitamin D toxicity.
Well, that being said, vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. So it is stored in the fat. So it's not even that if you suddenly stop taking excess amounts of vitamin D, the vitamin D level will drop right away. You can take months to clear excessive amounts of vitamin D, which of course causes the hypercalcemia, which of course predisposes to the kidney stones and, you know, other complications. And I guess I don't want to leave the last part of the question, which was about being on the hormonal, the hormonal contraceptive pill and multiple pregnancies, which we said can increase the risk of weight gain. And then I don't know what the age bracket is. Is this perimenopausal weight gain? And is there an annual physical going on where we could screen for insulin resistance and other causes of abnormal weight gain? So it sounds like a visit to the primary doctor might be in order. And then a referral, you know, if it's appropriate, if something comes back on initial screening. So I would say if she's tired and gaining weight, take her in to the primary doctor and let's start with that routine annual screening.
Well, that's always, part of my public service announcement in regards to birth control. Get your the woman in your life off the birth control pill. There's, even if it's a small increased incidence of DVT, of a stroke, weight gain, depression, get a vasectomy.
So you want to do a vasectomy, get a vasectomy, right? You got to snip.
It doesn't affect your erections. It doesn't affect your prowess. In fact, it can save you up to $200,000 to $250,000 a year, and you're not going to get your sweetheart pregnant. That's a matter of fact in Bahamian society.
Let's go back to the skin as an endocrine organ. And, you know, vitamin D is metabolized in the skin, right? And there's always this talk about people with more pigment.
Right.
You know, less able to metabolize vitamin D or produce or absorb mm-hmm. vitamin D. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, I think our audience would want to know something
about
that. Yeah,
so there is some evidence that increased pigmentation can decrease your absorption of vitamin D. And, you know, I've found that vitamin D deficiency is very prevalent.
It is.
But I think a lot of that is perhaps we're spending a lot less time outdoors than we think we are.
True.
So we come
and
in.
And we have on a whole lot of clothes, right?
Right. We come in the morning and then we're at work when we're at work. And then by the time we're leaving work, we are in the evening. And so the exposure, but I mean, you also have to weigh the risks and benefits. What are the other risks of excessive skin exposure to sunlight?
Right.
So are you better off supplementing your vitamin D and getting a moderate amount of sunlight exposure because of the risks? Perhaps, perhaps not. And so, of course, the kidneys are involved in the metabolism of vitamin D. The intestinal border is involved in the metabolism of vitamin D. So metabolism of vitamin D is a multi-organ, mechanism.
It's the gut, the skin, mm-hmm. and the kidneys all involved mm-hmm. in
all
that.
All involved in that.
And people with renal failure also have a significant problem metabolizing vitamin D.
Right, and activating their
vitamin
D.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of information coming out, and there's actually a syndrome called chronic fatigue syndrome, and that is a devastating condition that affects so many persons.
It's like fibromyalgia.
Just like fibromyalgia. In fact, there was a landmark journal article that came out that showed chronic fatigue syndrome, which is called CFS as for short, which is myalgic encephalomyelitis. It shows that the significant differences in the gut microbiome. We spoke a lot about that in regards to the gut microbiome and your increased risk of numerous malignancies with your husband last week. So when you compare the gut microbiome of someone who has chronic fatigue syndrome and that of a healthy individual, there are numerous differences and profound differences. And these differences are called dysbiosis. And it includes reduced bacterial diversity, altered composition within the specific bacteria, whether it's more of a specific bacteria or less abundance of certain bacteria. So the gut microbiome is a new field in medicine that's growing by leaps and bounds. There's more information coming out every year, and it has such a profound effect on us as an individual and in terms of our health, our risk of becoming obese, our risk of developing heart disease, our risk of developing cancers. It can be instrumental in terms of just our energy levels. What do you have to say about the gut microbiome? I know that's a major topic, but
that's probably an entire show.
It is
gut
it
microbiome.
Is. Well, let's bring you back to talk about the gut microbiome. I mean, yes. We actually bring you and your husband,
right? But let's seem that we are on the endocrine. Let's end the show talking about fight or flight, and so. The last organ that we want to talk about today in the endocrine system is the adrenal gland. So we spoke about the pancreas, we spoke about the thyroid, and the other big one is really the adrenal gland that really affects, again, the cardiovascular system.
Right.
It affects things. It is, again, affect all aspects of metabolism in some way.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about that before we end the show.
So before we end the show, the adrenal gland is probably something you don't think about much if you don't have a problem.
Right.
So there are, you know, there's different parts of the adrenal gland and there's different zones in the adrenal glands that produce different hormones. So, I mean, probably the savvy, the media savvy and the big hormone that everybody talks about is cortisol. And people talk about adrenal fatigue and I'm not making enough cortisol. So cortisol is one of those hormones that's important in maintenance of well-being, maintenance of blood pressure. Excess amounts of cortisol can predispose to weight gain. So patients come in asking, screen me for Cushing's because I'm making too much cortisol. And that's why, and sometimes they feel that maybe they're stressed, so they're overproducing cortisol. So there's lots of things about the adrenal gland that bring patients in. The inadequate production of cortisol mm-hmm. can lead to what we call adrenal insufficiency. And so that is going to be present in patients who have perhaps a higher risk of inflammatory disorders.
Right.
Sometimes they can feel lightheaded, dizzy, fatigued, weight loss, changes in the pigmentation of their skin. The next time parts of the adrenal come into play is when we're screening for patients who have severe hypertension
yes.
or sudden onset hypertension. So a patient
early onset
hypertension or difficult to control hypertension.
Right.
Then we're going to be screening for hormonal excess that is underlying the underlying cause of the hypertension. So if you have uncontrolled hypertension, if you're on 5 or 6 blood pressure pills, or if you're very young, then we want to screen you for what we call secondary causes of hypertension. So things like aldosterone, the fight or flight, you know, this is like the 2-minute endo course
yes.
on adrenal, the fight or flight response and production of adrenaline and noradrenaline. These are rare disorders where you are producing excessive amounts of adrenaline, and those things are called pheochromocytomas. Very infrequently you'll see those conditions, and those patients come in with what we call episodic hypertension. So that fight or flight mechanism is mediated by the hormone adrenaline or epinephrine, depending on if you're British or American. And that same, you know, periods of heart racing, hypertension, headache, you feel like I gotta run, something's happening, but nothing's actually chasing you. Could be because you're producing inappropriately elevated amounts of adrenaline at random times that cause the development of these, what we call episodic symptoms. So if you're having episodic, or meaning not consistent, you know, intermittent blood pressure elevations along with other symptoms, you might want to come in to your doctor and start a discussion. So
and you never,
too much to talk about.
You never, you never ignore these symptoms because it can lead to a stroke.
True, absolutely.
Or other issues. And although it's not very common, if you have an adrenal lesion,
right.
for example, it can even be malignant. So we can talk a little bit more about that from your perspective.
I mean, that's that very rare.
It is.
Right.
But the benign ones are more common. Right. And the benign ones that are overproduce hormones. So whenever you have a lesion in the adrenal, you got to think about whether it's producing hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes you just have small cysts in the adrenal.
Mm-hmm.
It's asymptomatic, nothing to do about that. But if it's producing, then that's when we have an issue. But the adrenal is important. The fight or flight is just in regular day life.
True.
I mean, it's if you have...
Absolutely.
When your body has a threat, you have to get engaged to move. And I mean, that's part of what the adrenal is important about, right?
Absolutely.
To get you there.
Right? Well, let's change the topic just at the end here. You are a successful Bahamian woman, well respected. You're also a mother.
Yes.
You're also a wife, and you come from a successful family. I know your mother. She instilled in all
Your brothers.
Yes, all your brothers instilled the importance of academics. We're always here preaching, Dr. Wesley Francis and I, no matter what your circumstances, no matter where you're coming from, education can rise you above and beyond and always reach for the stars. We're worried about a generation of a waywardness of young men out there. You and I and Dr. Wesley Francis and every other physician can see that what 80, 90% of medical students coming out are female. As a mother, how can we... In a few statements, how do you think we can turn things around for this generation of men who have given up hope and see no hope for themselves academically or in the future? Yes,
that's a tough one.
What is from your perspective? What is going wrong, and how can we turn things around?
So, from my perspective, I think there's so many things that need to be done. So, for younger children and young men in society, we probably need to start focusing on what we call self-confidence and start focusing on investing in the men. And I know in a lot of families, what happens is you know, people say, well, this is my good daughter, and I'm going to make sure that she does not need to depend on any man. So all of the resources get poured into the girl, because we want to go and make sure that our girl is taken care of. And so what happens to the boy? In many scenarios, not all, he is left. Well, you could work. You could go and fend for yourself. So we probably have to have a shift in our thinking and make sure that we're paying as much attention to our young men as we are our young ladies. And that is in the home basis. In society basis, I think we need to start focusing on maybe honing in on the young men that we see maybe struggling academically, and maybe, you know, pouring in or investing more resources in them. Because when they lose confidence, and when we lose confidence in them, they lose confidence in themselves. And when a man feels that he is unable to produce and perform, he turns to other ways that he can have validation and fulfillment. And sometimes that validation and fulfillment comes from external sources that can lead them towards other sources of reinforcement, violence, yeah. Depending on the approval of their peers. And the peers that they're seeking the approval from may not be the best examples and may not be leading them in the way that they should go. So, but this is a complex issue. I think we need to have a show on it.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for that issue. Segue, mm-hmm. and we do invite you back mm-hmm. to talk about exactly that. When you're coming back, I put you on the spot. I'll wait to hear from you. But I thank you for coming. You imparted a lot of important information.
It was a great show.
You definitely need to come back. And
absolutely.
You, just as your husband needs to come back, we can make it a family affair. So one week,
pituitary.
Yeah, 1 week. You can watch the kids. The next week, your husband can watch the kids, and we'll impart a lot of information to our Bahamian.
Yeah,
our Bahamian society. Thank you very much.
Bahamas.
Have a good evening.